Thing to say about the blues is about feelings, and for most of this century music has been about the only vehicle that Black America has had to tell its story at all, to say what it feels and what it wants. And out of the harshest slave system that there's ever been, the American chattel slave system was much tougher than anything in Africa, I think has come the most moving art that modern America, capitalist America, has produced. And the source of the power of blues singers, and women blues singers particularly, is their ability to empty out their experience of their suffering and their longings in a very forceful idiom. There's a description of Bessie Smith singing. She was taken up to New York to meet some high life people, and she sat in the front parlour and drank a bottle of gin and just walked up to, there's another bloke playing the piano, and started singing. She sang for an hour and just went off. And this is a description of her. This was no actress. This was no imitator of a woman's woes. There was no pretense. It was the real thing. A woman cutting her heart open with a knife until it was exposed for all of us to see, so that we suffered as she suffered, exposed with a rhythmic ferocity. It was almost impossible to bear it. And Carmen McRae, who's a very good singer herself, talking about Billie Holiday, said, she sings the way she is. It's really Billie when you hear her on a record. Singing is the only place she can express herself the way she'd like to be all the time. The only way she's happy is through a song. The only way she's at ease and at rest with herself is when she sings. And when Billie Holiday was in the reformatory second time, because of drugs, because of her addiction to heroin, all the girls, mainly Italian women, said, why don't you sing? Why don't you sing in penitentiary? And she says in her autobiography, they didn't understand. I couldn't sing because I was so unhappy. And the only time I could sing was when I was with myself. And it's sort of as if the only way that white people can approach the blues, and it's very apparent in Tony Palmer's awful television program, is if they sort of, the emotional nakedness is so strong that You have to cloak yourself in a kind of protective sentimentality about these people, and you have to see singers as victims, and you have to say their power came from the intensity of their suffering. And so you make Bessie Smith into this flamboyant gin-soaked mummer who dies in a roadside tragedy. And you turn Billie Holiday, like the film of Billie Holiday, into a sort of jazz melodrama with her face gently becoming more and more helpless and smudged, and her gardenia slipping and heroin doing her over. And in a sort of way, I think Janis Joplin was into that, because there's a sort of white thing that, you know, what the way you can make great music is by reproducing the circumstances of her idol's pain. And so you get into booze and heroin and broken up life, love life, and by that means you can recreate the artistry of the original blues singers. And what I want, the simple thing I want to say is that if you read what Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith said, they weren't victims. They understood what was happening to them all the time, that Billie Holiday continually makes incredibly clear things about capitalism, about money, about sex, and about race. She's not this smudged, naive person. She's a woman who understands what's going on and sings about what's going on. And if you listen carefully to how she sings, if you listen as a Marxist, which requires very good hearing, and you're listening through the music and to the, when she sings like just now, well, it says a lot, I think. America is a slave system, and the whole emergence of America is about slavery. The chattel slave system began when the Europeans, people in Bristol and Liverpool and so on, used their ships and their guns to take tens of millions of West Africans to work as slaves on the sugar and the rice and the tobacco plantations in the Deep South. Now, after the discovering of the milling methods, which you could, the gin that you could produce, Bessie Smith is always singing about these things, about tobacco and cotton and things. When that got discovered, that a method of pulling the seeds out of the cotton, it was impossible to extend the way that cotton could be profitably grown from the very Deep South right across America. And in fact, it's not true that the slavery is just a Southern system. The whole of America has been indirectly benefited by slavery in the South. It's made possible America's industrial expansion in the North and has made modern America what it is. The system was the most repressive that has ever been. The slave in America was utterly powerless. The only provider that the slave had was the master. He was the source of all punishment, all privilege, all wealth. Your relation to life was your relation to the master. Slaves could not assemble. They could not come together in more than three people unless a white man was present. The blacks were systematically cut off from education. A white woman who taught a slave to read was sentenced to prison for 6 months. So a white woman was sent to prison for teaching a slave to read, so you can realize how important it was that they couldn't read. It's almost impossible to resist that kind of system. There were only two, and if you look at the whole of slave systems, there was only really two big uprisings, that of Spartacus, or Kirk Douglas, often known, and the rising in Haiti that was played by Marlon Brando. Those are the two successful slave revolts. The risings in the South, the risings in 1800, the Denmark Vesey rising in 1822, Nat Turner, who's very important, one of the most successful slave risings, 1831, they were put down with the utmost brutality. They were put down not just with the ringleaders, not just the people who are thought to be the imagined ringleaders, but anyone connected was brutalized. They were murdered in front, in public, they were castrated, the level of destruction was just very difficult for us to understand. And it's those memories which are in the voices, I think, of Bessie and Billie. Billie Holiday talks about when she's working in 1940s in New York, and she says, I may have been wearing silk, but I was still working on the plantation. Her grandmother was a chattel slave, had eight children by a white man, and when she grew up, she was being taught about this. Bessie Smith was soaked in the memories of this kind of society, and that's what makes their music the strength. Sexually, within slavery, there's a kind of ghastly equality. Because the white man is the only provider, he becomes the sort of collective father for the whole plantation. And black men have a very weak situation. Curiously, black women, and that, I think that's why Bessie Smith comes from, are very strong in relation to the men. They work all the time. Black women always had to work on the plantations. They worked as field laborers, they worked as domestic servants, they worked as providers of childcare for the white owners. And they were also, their reproductive work was really acknowledged. Women bore babies. They wanted kids. They wanted a new generation of slaves. Some plantations' only purpose was breeding of slaves. And so women's position in relation to men was really quite important. The thing is that the black woman legally was the slave owner's personal property. He could do with her what he wanted, and he could do with her sexually as well as any other kind of way. And so it's quite usual for the man of the family or his son to relieve himself sexually and get their first sexual experience with black domestic servants. And it was considered just because they were black, that was sufficient invitation to fuck them. And black women, even after, you know, even after the Civil War and the emancipation in the South, black women were always denied, quite consciously, any kind of sexual, the little rights and privacies that they might have had. Just a simple example, the toilets, you know, in the South. I remember when I first went to the South, which was about 10 years ago, and I arrived on a Greyhound bus in a place called Bogalusa in Louisiana. And there, I got off the bus, and it was a white, emaciated, horrible kind of sub-Elvis creature, and a black woman, a very old black woman, sitting in a, you know, really exhausted, sitting on a chair. This guy got up, she was sitting in the wrong place. He got up, walked over to the ice refrigerator machine, which they have in all southern bus stations, got himself a cup of cold water, walked back very slowly, and slung it in this black woman's face. And what was interesting was that she didn't do anything. She just got up, sort of apologizing for herself, and walked across the room and sat in the right place. But that's still going on in the South until really very recently. And it's always been the law that there's very strict laws, just simple things, like black women are not allowed to try on clothes in the South because they're imagined to have this fantastic smell, and this smell has something to do with sexuality. And if they put the clothes on, it might stain them in such a way that the whites might then have to wear them close to their skin. There's an awful lot about rape and about how black men and women couldn't have any dignity. Rape was and lynching were the methods used to terrify people, and there were mass methods. Not just 5 or 6 people raped or 10 or 12 people lynched. Lynching went on an average of 500 cases a year in the South, right the way through the late 19th century. Women took a very big part in fighting lynching, in fact. But lynching was always about sex when it came down to it. It was about, I'm a white man, I can rape your woman, and you can't do anything about it. And if you look at a lot of the stories of lynching, what happens is that there's a drunk kid, white rich kids get drunk. They go to the black part of town, they maybe go to a brothel or something like that. They find a woman, they gang rape the woman, and then they go and find her man. Because they want, not only do they want to humiliate the woman, but they want to humiliate the man too. They want to rub the man's face in his own powerlessness. And they want to say, look, we just fucked your woman, you know, what are you going to do about it? And again that happens. And if a man does anything about that, then they lynch him. And you read this story, if a man picks up a gun or has a weapon or tries to fight back, then immediately that becomes an enormous scene. And that is the worst thing you can do, is defend a woman in the Deep South if you're black. Although the Deep South is very full of chivalry, and, you know, they really treat ladies like they're absolutely wonderful, as long as they're white and rich. The brutality on the other side of that is horrific. And when they lynch people, they string them up very inefficiently. They used to do it to socialists too. They string them up very inefficiently, so they strangle them to death. I mean, if you're hung under capitalism, you break your neck in 30 seconds. But in the Deep South, it would take an hour to strangle someone to death. Then they would throw kerosene and tar over the body of that person, and they would set light to that. So even as they were dying, they'd probably be burning too. And they would finally cut off their genitals. And that was a very important thing. They did it to the IWW organizer, Wesley Everett. And it was a very important thing for the white men of the South to retain their rule. When I'm saying about slavery being brutal, that was what it was about. It was about real deep psychological fear. And what happened to the black woman was that she was either a whore or she was with a white man. And she was attributed with this enormous sexuality as a kind of macabre consolation prize for her awful situation. And so just one quote before I talk about how that affects Bessie, of a woman, I mean, a really desperate situation where the black man has no dignity. The only way he can get any kind of strength is taking it out on his woman. The woman has no dignity either. And a woman said in the 1890s, a woman who was active against lynching, we poor colored women wage earners in the South are fighting a terrible battle. On the one hand, we are assailed by white men. On the other hand, we are assailed by black men who should be our natural protectors. And even then, whether in the cookhouse or in the wash tub or over the sewing machine or behind the baby carriage or at the ironing board, we're little less than pack horses. We're beasts of burden. We're slaves both to black men and white men. And a woman says this, a black woman, sort of understanding it, talks about how the mass of Negro men are engaged in menial occupations throughout their working day. Their baffledness and their fear makes them take it out on us. And if you listen to the music of the time and then you listen to the blues, you can hear all that sadness in the blues. If you listen to the country blues, the very early stuff that's on the collector's records, it's high, heavy, repeated chants of convict labourers. There's the early blues singers, Blind Blake particularly, a sort of singing that's near a howl, the rasping mouth harp, the harsh metallic fingering of the country blues singers. And it's almost like the sound of following work across those empty plains of the South with the odd train whistle or something. There was no jollity in it. The jollity was in the official popular music of the day, which was played on pianos in houses, and it was the waltzes and the quadrilles and the mazurkas and the polkas that all the other European immigrants took there. But the blacks weren't allowed to have any music recorded. Every race has a flag but a coon, said the music publishers. Another music publisher in 1920 said, Negroes just sing about what they eat and who they fuck. And the manager of OK Records, who was the first person to record Bessie Smith, said, we've got records by all foreign groups. We've got German records, Swedish records, Polish records, but we're afraid to advertise Negro records. So he originally listed them as race records. And that's how you look at Oleod Blues. It's what's called, it's on the race label. And in fact, suprema, and in jazz terms, that the people who first marketed jazz nationwide in America was a white band, which had the nerve to call itself the original Dixieland Jazz Band, but had just rushed in. And, you know, jazz rushed into the mainstream of commercial American music without so much as a black face on it. Now, the classic blues and the blues of the... maybe we ought to play one fairly soon, but Bessie Smith, there's a beautiful record about her man called... he's an old pack horse and he's sure broke down. But they originate in the minstrel tradition and in like something like the music hall, which used to go around the Deep South, a touring variety show with freaks and jugglers and sword swallowers and everything else. But in that tradition, women had a fantastic power. Women came, and this wasn't just Bessie Smith, but it's Ma Rainey, who was the mistress of them all. Lots of other, Clara Smith, Chippy Hill, Victoria Spivey, who wrote fantastically good political songs about TB and about cocaine and all sorts of interesting subjects. And the classic blues came at a particular time in the history of the American black. It came at the point that black America, which had been in the Deep South, was moving from a mainly rural, mainly southern, mainly sort of peasant and small farmer life into the factories, into the big cities of the North. The classic blues caught black America as it was opening up to the North, but before it had completely departed. It caught a kind of transition point between a folk music and urban music. And it had that religious thing in it as well. It had a sanctified self-expression about it. If you listen to Bessie, she sings somber, but she sings really powerful. She sings like a preacher. And that, if you listen to Danny Barker, who was her guitarist for a long time, she said Bessie was a fantastic deal to watch. She had a whole church deal mixed up in it. If you have any church background, like the people who come from the South like I did, you'd recognize the similarity between what she was doing and what those preachers and evangelists from there did, and how they move people. Bessie did the same thing on stage. In a sense, she was like Billy Graham or something. That's what he says. Bessie was in a class with those people. She could bring about Matt's hypnosis. The sort of starkness of her music, the way it's 12 bars, it's harsh, it's inescapable. Frank Walker, another of her, she said it's all a matter of feeling with her. She used to drink fantastically. She used to drink two bottles before she went on stage. Frank Walker said, it's all a matter of feeling with her. It's all inside. There was no repression. It just comes out in her singing. All the blues she sung was a sort of a story. And a story... Yeah, let's play.
Look daddy, out on a stallion, get out. Restaurant this very night.
I was saying how nice it would be just to listen to that. The point is, it's difficult to listen to it here, but the thing about, I think, the way she sings is this, and it's hard to hear the words, but there's a fantastic knowledge and sadness in the way she sings. And if any, that's not a very good example. I mean, that's a song about a man who's letting her down and what she wants of men. But if ever there was a woman who sung I Am Woman, it's her. If you listen to how she takes the bawdiness out of the vaudeville tradition and the old rival medicine show tradition and turns it into something more subtle, there's, well, I just listen to her and find more about what she's on about all the time. There's a sort of magnificent frankness about her. She's very insistently physical. She's always talking about in a lot of images to do with work and cooking and so on, but she's always talking about lovemaking, really. She's always talking about her pride. She's got a very defiant, although her voice sounds very like a funeral, almost, very serious, there's a very insistent defiance. There's a beautiful song, which I didn't bring with me, about which she sings when she's quite old, very stately, upright, kind of strong woman voice. I'm a young woman and ain't done running around. Some people call me a hobo. She wrote it herself. Some people call me a bum. No one knows my name. No one knows what I've done. But I'm as good as any in your town. I ain't no high yellow, which means that she's a black woman. She's a black, black. She's not a and there's a lot of... She was a race woman. She said she used to speak proudly about being a race woman. She used to speak for Marcus Garvey and used to talk... when she was singing about politics, and she said, I'm a race woman, which means that she's a black, black. And it's very insistent, that kind of, sort of, it sounds a bit quaint sometimes, and it sounds a bit stagey, but when she says, I ain't no high yellow, I'm a deep yellow brown, I ain't going to marry, I ain't going to settle down, I'm going to drink some good moonshine and run these browns down. She was living all the, she lived like a sort of a gigantic opera singer, really. She used to have this entourage and go around and dress real fast and drink an awful lot, but all the time she was being robbed solid. Mesmero wrote about her that she went on for years being robbed by stingy managers who'd murder their own mothers for a juice of blips, having to parade around in gaudy gowns full of dime store junk and throw away a great art while lushes and morons made cracks about her size and shape. She drank a lot, and there must have been plenty of nights when she got the blues she couldn't lose, but she just went on singing, pouring out the richness and beauty in her which never dried up. And I think there's a different, well, I think I found myself listening to a lot of women singers, and I used to like R&B and Chicago music and music of the 30s and 40s much more, which is much more raucous, you know, and it's what the whole of modern rock and roll is based on. But the thing about women singers, that tradition is very much the male blues. It's very footloose, it's very aggressive, it's full of sexual boastfulness, it's delinquent, it's kind of I'm a hoochie-coochie man kind of thing. The classic blues, and Billy and Bessie Smith particularly, are very much women blues. They're the other side of the coin, if you like. They're the people on the receiving end of the hoochie-coochie men. They're the people who are the tragic people. They're talking about jealousy. They're talking about being deserted. They're talking about pulling yourself through love affairs. It's about picking yourself up after Mr. Hoochie-coochie's gone on to another town. About the joy of when it's happy, but about how desperate it is when it's sad. It's really stripped of the bare essentials about what it meant to be a woman at that time. In most of the male blues, women are just these things out there that you've got to get, and they're objects of sexual gratification. There's little love in those songs, really. I mean, they're great music. There's not a lot of feeling. The despair, if it's in the male blues, is sort of self-despair. But in the women blues, there's a different kind of thing. There's a defiant, there's a possibility of human joy. There's a tragic sense of this transitory moment of happiness, which is, you know, is going to go, but while you've got it, you want to have it. There's a precision about the imagery in Bessie Smith's songs that isn't in the men's blues, and there's a fantastic ability to place emotion in really concrete situations very clearly, and that, I'm sure, is the power of the music when you listen to it again and again, because it came out of a very, very bleak world, and what happened to Bessie is really... Not just that she got robbed and she got fucked around and she used to have to play in places no one listened, but she just got killed, really. She wasn't a high-stepping, happy-go-lucky, you know, wonderful Hollywood kind of blues singer. She just had a life of misery, and she ended up in 1934 literally bleeding to death when segregated hospitals and so-called doctors just shunted her from pillar to post before anyone could get round to finding a ward that was low enough to take the body of this woman who is one of the greatest artists of 20th century America. And she she died as she lived, neglected, not particularly interested. No one was very interested in recording her music. She was fat and she was sad a lot of the time. And that's what her music's about. Her music's not about tapping your feet at all. And really, what happened when she died was, I think, 10 years of the classic blues disintegrated. Everyone went north, really. The blacks wanted to escape. The depression devastated the Deep South. The only way you could get out was on that railway line that ran 1,000 miles north from the Delta to right up to Chicago. In Chicago, there were jobs, allegedly. There was the Chicago Defender, which was a black newspaper, which was quite black conscious. There was Sears Roebuck, and all the South people used to read the catalogue of Sears Roebuck and say, well, they must be good up there. What happened to women on that journey was terrible. Women in the South had some kind of power. They had jobs. They had a kind of authority. When women went north, well, women didn't go north. Mainly it was the men who went north. But when they got north, they were forced back into being domestics or just being the familiar options of being a whore or being a mother of children you couldn't afford to keep. And women get wiped out of music in the 30s. They don't have their own forms, which Bessie created. They went back into gospel a bit or into romantic styles. But the blues that took a footing, really, in the 30s was the Chicago South Side music. Boogie Woogie Piano, that the people used to play at rent parties, the sort of music that you heard in the bars, raw, bouncy, very male. It held the blues line, really, but it was great to dance to. There's no place for women in it, though. There's one woman singer called Memphis Minnie who's terrific, who sounds a bit like Bessie Smith with electric guitar, and I wish I got some music of hers, but God, she's hard as nails. I mean, and that's the only way she existed. There's one of her boyfriends, Johnny Shines, described how she was. And I mean, Bessie was tough, but this woman was, any man would fool with her, she'd go for them right away. She wouldn't take any foolishness off them. Guitar, pocket knife, pistol, anything she had to hand, she'd use it. You could say Memphis Minnie was a real hellcut, you know? Sonjo, Roosevelt, Sykes used to work there, and boy, they used to have some terrible rows, but Memphis Minnie would be the winner every time. And you could tell that she must have been a real tougher, but I mean, that was the only way, you know, the music of Bessie Smith is this fragmentary moment when the blacks are going from north, south to north, when women are in quite a powerful position, it evaporates. And the way women reappear in the 40s is very, very subdued, because after the blues of the 30s, the R&B, the next black music that really made places was from Kansas, and it was big band music, and it was tightly orchestrated. The Jimmy Lunsford Band, the Basie Band, a lot of the most beautiful music, but there's no place for women in that except singing very sentimental songs. You have to be Jimmy Rushing. You have to have a fantastic voice that can stand up to an eight-man brass section to be able to sing that. And it's very difficult to cut through that. And women either sang very sentimental things or they didn't sing at all. Or they sang gospel. And gospel was the important area where women could find a place. Again, a religious idiom, a very pure idiom, but it was an idiom. And you think of the modern, I mean, Aretha Franklin particularly comes completely out of the gospel tradition, I think. Nina Simone, too. The great singer of the 30s was Mahalia Jackson, who was, in fact, a beautician in Chicago and went in to sing. And she, just a quote from her about what it was like singing. She used to go to these religious concerts right through the Deep South and get fantastic reception. A white preacher would introduce her on the stage. And she'd get back in her car and she says, the moment I left the concert hall, I felt as if I'd stepped back into the jungle. From Virginia to Florida, it was a nightmare. There was no place for us to eat or sleep on the main highways. The restaurants wouldn't serve us. Teenage white girls who were serving a car would come bouncing out towards our car, and they'd stop dead when they saw we were Negroes. They'd spin round without a word and walk away. Some gasoline stations wouldn't even sell us gas or oil. Some told us there were no restrooms available. The looks of anger at the sight of us coloured folks sitting in a nice car was frightening to see. And I think that's really interesting about racism. People, whites don't mind blacks as long as they stay in their bloody place, but if blacks have a car and want to get gas and want to get served at a station, boy, they get into terrible trouble. And so this was still what it was about. And Billie Holiday is still about that. Billie's really in the 40s, but her mother when she was pregnant with Billie, had to scrub the floors at a maternity home to earn enough money so she could have the baby in hospital. Her grandmother, as I said, was a slave. And Billie says, this is Billie Holiday, she said, my gran told me what it felt like to be a slave, to be owned body and soul by a white man who is the father of her children. And Billie Holiday describes the first job she had when she was a maid for a white woman. She remembers being called a nigger, with the first time. Instead of telling me what she wanted me to do, she'd get all excited because her husband was waiting, and she'd start hollering at me and call me nigger. I never heard that word before. I didn't know what it meant, but I could guess from the sound of her voice. And all the Billie Holiday's life, that word nigger came back into it. Whether it was the sheriff who'd come up to the bandstand, you know, when she was playing in the South and say, when's Darkie going to sing? Or the fact that she had to dress up white, put white makeup on in order to get on the thing. An integrated club, you know, she could sing to whites, but she couldn't go through the front door. She got slung out for walking through the front door. She had to go through the back door. There's a case when she's just singing and a Navy guy comes and listens to her and says, fantastic music, nigger. And she just doesn't know how to cope with it. All the time, it's completely grinding her down. And a friend describes meeting her after that. And it was 2 weeks afterwards, and she says, how are you, Billy? And Billy says, oh, okay, you know, I'm still a nigger. And then when she's touring Count Basie Band, she had to continually paint up with this special grease paint, because not that she wasn't black enough in that case. A sheriff came along and looked at her face and said, oh, you're too white, you've got to get blacker. So she had to black her face up in that case. She's drinking with a white guy, and another drinker comes up, and a white man who's drunk again, and says, what the hell's going on? A man can't bring his wife into this bar anymore without you tramp white men bringing nigger women in here. Now, if she'd been a prostitute, that would have been all right. But because she wasn't a prostitute, it was an insult. When she went on tour, and that's quite good in the film of Billie Holiday with Diana Ross in it, which isn't all that bad a film, she says, I got to the point where I could hardly eat or sleep or go to the bathroom without having a major production. Now, the band, the white band, and many Jewish people in that band supported her all along the line in that thing, but it just got really wearing her down. And she says about the North, at least in the South, you know where you are, they just insult you to your face. She says, a cracker just wants you to clean up his house or take care of his kids and get the hell out of it. In the North, it's different. The big deal hotels, the agencies and the network apply it to your face. They give you a fast shove in your back. This makes life a constant drag, just not for me, but for the people I meet and like. You're always under pressure. You can fight it, but you can't lick it. The only time I was free from that kind of pressure was when I was a call girl. When I was a call girl, I had white men as my customers. No one gave us any trouble then. People can forgive any damn thing if they do it for money. And she's always saying that about money. She talks about drugs in relation to money, and prostitution in relation to money, and music in relation to money. She understands what's going on very clearly. And she liked England for that reason. She loved England because it wasn't racist. People in France, she spent a lot of time in France. She wanted to go and live in France. And it's really difficult for Max Jones, who writes on Melody Maker, who's a very fine critic and was a great supporter of Billie Holiday at a time when she wasn't liked in America very much. Talks about how difficult it was for him to understand. For us, he says, she was quite simply the greatest, the most expressive, the most rhythmically stimulating of all the vocalists who've come to predominance in America. And she was the most treasured woman singer since Bessie Smith. She should have enjoyed wealth and fame. It wasn't easy for us to understand that in our own country she was still very poorly paid, very badly treated. She earned next to nothing for those marvellous LPs that she made regularly, and for which we in England saved up our spare shillings for an almost religious dedication. I mean, she just said about her managers that if it had been left to management and promoters, I would have shot myself a long time ago. She goes on and on about how the cycle sort of works, that you get onto drugs, people give you money to get onto drugs, and you have to spend a lot of money to get off drugs. Then you have to give a lot of money to lawyers to represent you in court. It's all a cycle that she smouldered down in. There's a beautiful description of her when she was, I mean, her later life was incredibly unhappy. She was really deserted by a lot of people. She lived in New York. No one wanted to hear her music. She was a boring, fat black. You know, she wasn't with where it was at, whatever the trend was then. And she had to go and sing in Europe quite a lot of time out of real financial desperation. And I think also because of the happy memories of the first time she went to Europe. And she went to sing in Milan in a place called the Smeraldo Theatre, which I went to see because I think it's such a fantastic story. She was on this stage with variety acts and jugglers and pop impersonators singing pop songs. And then Billie Holiday had to come out and sing. And she got booed off the stage. And she was really misused. Because, I mean, you just shouldn't be put on like that. Incomprehensible. You know, they thought she was going to swallow a sword and she wanted to sing the blues. And Hazel Scott, who was another singer, met her in Paris shortly after that. And it gives you a really good idea of her pride, that there she was in a crappy little club in Paris with a lot of businessmen talking loudly, and she was trying to sing. And she couldn't sing badly. The thing about Billie Holiday, is she couldn't sing badly. She just didn't sing. She either sang 100% or not at all. So she was singing really beautifully in this club. And I've talked to people who've heard her sing in clubs in London. And she was just amazed. She could just capture things. The room changed when she started singing. She sang four songs and went away, and everyone didn't know what had happened. And this is, Hazel went up to her in this club, the Mars Club in Paris, and she was being given a really rough time. And she says she's been misused again by people who didn't care a damn about her. She's been given a rough time by the French public because her voice wasn't what they wanted. She was singing in a little club for whatever percentage she could get. And Hazel Scott sat in the back, and she just started crying. And Billy stopped singing and walked over to Hazel, who was the only other black woman in the club, and pulled her by the arm around to the back of the stage and says, "No matter what those motherfuckers do to you, don't ever let them see you cry." And that's the kind of pride that she had, that she'd die. She had taped to her leg some money because she was going to get out of that hospital and go and get drunk, and she had it taped to her leg. She was always, well, insisting on, I think, fighting, but fighting in this kind of very open way. If you listen to her music, you can hear that she's vulnerable. She is honest about the fact. She doesn't pretend like a lot of those great male singers, you know, always out. She just opens up, and that's what's so great about her singing. It just flows out, really. There's a song I would like to play that is, I've got a history to it. It's called Strange Fruit. It's probably her most famous song. And it was written for her in a mixed club in New York in the 30s by a black schoolteacher. It was written about lynching. The club is very interesting. It was run by a Jewish Communist Party shoemaker who ran a club, and the slogan of the club was "the right place for the wrong people." And it was kind of sort of like, I hope, Rock Against Racism would be. It was a place where left-wing people met and listened to music, who really loved music. And there's a trumpeter there who was in the Communist Party who apparently used to lecture the band on Marcus Garvey and the Russian five-year plan and things between gigs. And Billy didn't like this very much. She used to go out and get stoned instead. But it was a great club. And this guy brought her this song, and she was very unhappy about the song to start with, Strange Fruit. She thought she couldn't cope with it. It was called Cafe Society, this club, and the shoe trumpeter's name was Frankie Newton. And the trouble was, her main problem with Cafe Society was, because it was a left-wing club, there's very, very strict anti-marijuana ruling. And so she couldn't really deal with this. She used to have to go out all the time in a cart and drive around Central Park getting stoned. She used to get her own dope from Africa. It was part of her connection to Africa. There's a very interesting little story from one of her drummers who she gave a joint to. And he said it kept him stoned for 4 or 5 days, even though he ate like a pig and drank gallons of water. So she was quite keen on things. But Lewis Allen offered her this lyric about lynching, and she didn't like it at first. And then she said, "I chopped it with a ferocious passion." And she says, "I worked like the devil on it because I was never sure that I could put it across, or I could get it across to a nightclub audience about what it meant to me." And it's about the raw political feelings that she sometimes hid behind her own elegance. She said she had a lot of defences, but this song was about not having any defences. And she said it always reminded her of how her father died. Her father died in a segregated war with pneumonia. He was a musician. He died in Dallas, Texas. He had to wander around again like Bessie Smith to get in a hospital. And she said, "I had to keep on singing it, not only because of the people who asked for it, because after 20 years after Dad died, things that killed him are still happening in the South." And, well, if you put it in the song, it's really simple, but it's got fantastic dramatic power. And it talks about lynching, and you can almost hear the gallows ropes twisting, and you can hear what the Deep South is about, and the brutality which underlies all that.
Southern breeze, the poplar trees.
She regarded that song as a kind of litmus paper. It was the most important song she ever sang. She said it had a way of separating the straight people out from the squares and the cripples. She usually finished her set with it, because and the reason was that she used to give so much when she sang it. She was nearly always sick. She said, I always do. When I sing it, it affects me so much I get sick. It takes all the strength out of me. And she used to actually go off and have to puke after singing it often. There's one story in her thing when she's in the ladies, after singing that song, and a woman bursts into tears, comes in and bursts into tears and says, my God, I never heard anything so beautiful in my life. You can hear a pin drop out there still. And people who describe her singing that song, she just put her whole being into it. It was about politics, that song. And yet white still didn't understand it. And the white woman came up to her drunk one time and said, why don't you sing that sexy song about the naked bodies? She didn't understand what she was on about. And in that singing, you can hear the memories of being a slave from her grandmother, the memories of being owned by someone else. And she was always owned by someone else. She was always owned by men who started off as lovers and then stayed on to be businessmen or something, by managers who were much more interested in cash registers than in her music. She became owned by the dope that she turned to for relief that took her over. She lived in an allegedly desegregated society, which was still racist, where in many ways black women had less social power than they possessed in the days of Bessie Smith. There was no longer the sort of protection that Bessie Smith had. She had segregation, but she had a space for her own music. Ironically, when the blacks were produced and pulled into the marketplace, so their music was downtrodden in many ways. The blacks' music could only be integrated on the terms of the dominant culture, which was in terms of celebrity and pop and records. And even as a success, Billie Holiday was always forcibly made aware that her celebrity was about being a sexy black woman. It was a conditional, it was provisional, it was precarious. She could never escape the sexual projections which white America was always mounting against the blacks, particularly black women. No amount of fame would change her colour, no amount of fame would change her sex. In a lot of people's eyes, if you read the newspaper accounts of her trials, she was still very little better than a whore. She deserved her drug addiction, she deserved to be prosecuted by the police, because the racial superiority of white America is always buttressed by sexual contempt. And when she writes about this, when she was in the public gallery of the courtroom, when she was having to appear all the time, in the eyes of the people, the judges and the policemen, she said she could see the fears and loathings of the lynchers. She could see their hatred of just her existing. And she puts it beautifully. Morris summarizes her whole life. I decided one day I wasn't going to do anything unless I meant it. You have to be poor and black to know how many times you get knocked on the head for just trying to do something as simple as that. She just tried to be herself, and that was a crime to white America. And, well, I didn't really finish, but there was one other very beautiful thing I just recently found out about her, that she was in Paris quite late on in her life, really ill, and she found that there were some people from Algeria, some of the resistance people from Algeria. And when she heard about that, she immediately wanted to go and find the leaders of the African movement. And she went to a private meeting of them, a clandestine meeting. And they were underground. They were still very small. And she just went to them, and she just said, I've come here to sing to you. And she just sang three songs to these people and just went away, which is something very strong, I think. And she didn't want, you know, just wanted to give her energy in that kind of way. She also sang for the Communist Party a couple of times in the 30s. I'm not making her out to be a very political person in explicitly, but the way she behaved was just fantastically political. And although Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday are separated by 20 years, and they're in different parts of America, and the music business is at a very different stage of development, they've got the same experience and the same collective history, and they've both got this ability as women to take charge of music, to make their own idiom, to turn it into something unique. They were both proud to be black. They were both race women. They didn't flaunt their blackness, but they didn't deny it either. And they just both fought to relentlessly, consistently, to be themselves. They insisted in every note of their music that they're women. They're not men's playthings. They're not little cuddly creatures. They're committed to passion. They're interested in sex, but on their own terms and in their own right. They're affirming sexuality, but on their own terms. They're not a respectable sham imitation of white family life, which a lot of, you know, black singers got into. And you think of the whole Diana Ross syndrome, or what happens to the Supremes, or something like that. All the time, against constant pressure to abandon their roots, they stayed where they were, and that made it was very exhausting. The effort of keeping up that exterior alone, very isolated, constantly drained them. They were both very heavily into booze. They were both continually fucked over by men, but repeated the pattern in a desperate way. On the stage, they were greeted as outstanding, but off the stage, they had no rights. Just by being black in America, they were nonconformists. By being women and black and being proud of both of those things, they were just asking for trouble. They wounded very easily. They had a very suffering life, but they were great performers. And when it comes down to it, music is an art of performance. That's why it's hopeless talking about it or playing records. I'm not saying their oppression made them great, but their greatness lies in their ability to press through that oppression, to understand it, to go through a world that denies their feelings and turn those bruises and turn that pain by opening up, by expressing themselves completely into something that's incredibly beautiful and incredibly moving. And out of the bitterness of their lives came forth something incredibly sweet. And if you listen, if you're not into that music, do listen to it. And if you, whatever else, read the Billie Holiday's autobiography, because it's better than State and Revolution. It's the most political book I've ever read. Okay, that'll leave it there.
Deep.
Kiss him at night.